Hello, hello, and welcome everyone to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. Today I'm joined by Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you, Nick. Nice and sunny here today. Things are looking up.
And me as a fat man in spring, I'm sweating an awful lot up here in Johannesburg. And we are also joined by Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you?
Yes, very good. Spring is something I'm enjoying. A lot of outdoors time.
Which is exactly the reason I'm not enjoying it as well.
Yeah.
anyway, that's neither here nor there. All right, so let's start off with our first bit of news, and this is a big one. And we're all, I think, a little bit shocked by how quickly this story is back on our radar. So a few days ago, we talked about how the Land Courts Bill had passed through the Justice Committee and had been sent to the National Assembly. A process which usually takes some time. It seems that the National Assembly has already passed the Land Courts Bill. And so now it's going on to the National Council of Provinces, which is a bit of a breakneck speed, I think, for legislation, as far as my memory and experience serves. So, Gabriel, I want your thoughts on it, especially as you put out a media statement today, and you said that there's six major problems with this piece of legislation. What are your thoughts on the speed at which this went through the National Assembly? And also, can you just talk about these six deficiencies that you highlighted in your statement?
Sure. Thanks, Nick. Yeah, it's worrying. I'll answer the first question first. What do I make of the fact that this has moved from being signed off by the parliamentary committee to being voted on and passed by the National Assembly within a week? It's extraordinary, and it says to me that someone wants to get this thing implemented. Someone wants to use the powers that this thing allows sooner rather than later. That's very worrying. Why? Because the powers that it allows effectively kick the independence of the judiciary through the teeth. Let me try and go through the six major points that I think people should know that are concerning about this bill. And this is not an exhaustive list, but these are sort of like headline reasons that it's unconstitutional or that it's really bad. The first is there was no socioeconomic impact assessment. Since 2015, it's legally required that you have that assessment in order for the government to say its version of how much wrong is this going to do and how much good stuff is this going to do, so that can be part of the public debate. That didn't happen, so you can't say that the public participation process was just under the current regime. Okay, the bill requires, and I just want to quote directly here, that judges, I quote, must be representative in terms of race and gender. So that's unconstitutional. The Constitution says that judges first and foremost have to be appropriately qualified and fit and proper for the job. Then Section 174 says that the judiciary generally, and the same thing in 195 is true of the public administration, should be broadly representative of South Africa. If you want to, you can read that through like a race lens. I don't know that you have to. But if you want to read it through a race lens, you have to do so broadly. This thing is saying for a particular subset of the courts, there's the all kinds of courts. It's saying this court, you know, the judge president of this court, the deputy judge president, the judges must be representative. It's putting the cart before the horse. The Constitution says qualifications first, then maybe broadly consider the demographics. This is saying the other way around. Here's where it really gets worrying. Because that's the kind of thing that I think people already would have seen coming, in a sense, out of this administration, given how it talks all the time. Really concerningly, the Land Courts Bill says that two assessors can be part of any case as basically judges, and that they can outvote a judge in determining any question of fact. So not legal questions, but questions of what happened, what was someone thinking, and so on. Now, who are the assessors? Well, it just says the minister can appoint the assessors by regulation through his own way. So this would be the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services or something like that.
And South Africa has a long history of ministerial discretionary powers being used wisely, cleverly, and not simply to the benefit of cronies.
Shame on you, Nicholas. Shame on you. This is this is really bad. Basically, this is saying you're going to sit in front of a kangaroo court. Two of those assessors can be nice racist race nationalist Marxists who have been appointed by the minister, land activists who say the kinds of things that the EFF and Black First Land First say. And they can decide what happened and what didn't happen. Okay, are the rules of evidence going to help you out? No, because the evidence, I'm again quoting here, can be admitted in this court that could not be admissible in any other court of law. So there's a lower bar for this court than any other court of law. Okay? And in addition, hearsay evidence can be given whatever weight the land court deems appropriate. Okay, so the judges are going to be two assessors. The rules of evidence are not helping you either. What about appeal? We know how this game works. You know, sometimes people get a tough break in the first go, but then they can appeal. No. Here, you can't appeal to the Supreme Court of Appeal. That is completely written out by the Land Court Bill. You can only appeal to the Land Court Appeal Court. And it even says, you know, at the moment, you can technically appeal to the Constitutional Court, but legislation could block you from being able to appeal to the Constitutional Court too. So if this legislation stands on that point, then future legislation could say you can't even appeal there. Okay. And then finally, well, you might think I'm a normal dude. I would be toast in this kind of situation, but at least my lawyer can step in and help me out and do all the jujitsu lawyery stuff that lawyers do. No. Because it says the minister can force you into mediation or arbitration and can decide what the mechanism of the mediation and arbitration is. And specifically in 53.2e, please go look it up yourself if you doubt me, specifically says that the minister can revoke the right of any party to be represented legally in these proceedings. Okay, so that's 6 points. I can keep going. I can keep going all day with this. This is the kangaroo court bill. And the last thing...
Wait. Did you just say that the minister can revoke your right to be legally represented during a mediation?
Dude, it's in black and white.
Is insane.
Dude, this thing was passed within a week. Maybe partly because it's too hot to handle, you know? And I don't know who's, you know, we'll see who picks up on the story so far, but... This and the expropriation bill were both signed off at committee level last week. None of the Sunday papers mentioned either of those facts. The connection is severe. The fact is that the expropriation matters are in all likelihood going to be decided by these kangaroo courts under the land court. The just and equitable amounts will be decided by these guys. Evictions. All evictions are going to be decided by these guys. All unlawful entering and trespassing matters are going to be decided on these guys. So we've gone over it all before. But if you look at the four bills, the PIE Act, which is the only one that's already standing and has well-known damaging effects, the expropriation bill, the land courts bill, and the unlawful entering on premises bill, basically what they do is they legitimize a kind of Zimbabwean land grab situation step for step so that it's not smash and grab. It's grab by the book. That's unfortunate.
Indeed. Understating it in the way that I normally understate these things. Michael, what do you make of this? This seems like we're really kind of messing with the judiciary in a very fundamental way here.
Yeah. And picking up on Gabriel's last point, if we think back to, it would have been probably 2017, perhaps even a bit before Ramaphosa became ANC leader and president. I think he was already beginning to say these sorts of things, but certainly immediately afterwards. And I think Theresa May, maybe when she came out, and I can't quite remember the date of that, but it was an issue then. And the assurance that he kept making was that there was nothing to fear. There'd be no land grabs. The whole process would be within the terms of the law and nobody had anything to worry about. And the very great risk that, as Gabriel has set it out here, is what we're looking at is precisely the incorporation of legal principles or legal instruments to make it to make that a mercenary action by a ruling party that's desperate, faces losing power, using using the law to legitimate what it wants to do for easy or easier electoral gains. And I mean, this comes, you know, to a point where I think there's a gathering unanimity. You see it across even ANC people who are kind of not hostile to the ANC, maybe even hospitable to the ANC, saying things that are quite strongly pointing to the fact that the real problem in South Africa, right across the board, is deficient ANC policy and conduct. So as that, this gathering unanimity about what the real problem is occurring, we are seeing a desperate ruling party using powers, again, a phrase that that Gabriel used just now, using whatever powers it can to shore up its position and to its own advantage to seek easy electoral gains. And yeah, it does seem to be a very grave risk. Why else would they, you know, rush this through? It is very worrying. And why do we need, you know, additional courts? We have a very effective court system. Why do we need extra courts to deal with one aspect of civil and commercial life? Gabriel's point too about the vast skill that is contained within the appeal court. It hears cases right across the spectrum of law and society and commerce and trade and so on. It is a repository of all the skill. Why is that being excluded? It really just doesn't make sense. So yeah, deeply worrying.
Yeah, I must say that, you know, anytime I see legislation like this, you know, it's touching on fundamental right, which is, of course, in this case, right to property and due process and law and order, all that kind of stuff. And when you see lots of discretionary powers granted to ministers in this legislation, that's just a giant neon flashing warning sign saying bad, bad, bad. Mm. Because that is the gateway by which corruption, political abuse, all sorts of nonsense can take place. Gabriel.
Yeah, I've been around for some of the sort of mediation work in Mpumalanga and KZN that happens before things end up going to court. So often people try and avoid paying all of there's a lot of money that gets wasted when you are forced to go to court.
Yeah,
and I've got to tell you, it's pretty grisly. I mean. The first IRR report I did was on two black families who were driven off their land by a Zulu chief. Not a regular kind of chief, it must be said. This guy has credible allegations of multiple assassinations against him. An impi of heavily armed people came and drove them off their land. The police helped the impi take them off their land. Their houses were burnt and so on. That was the mediation process in that instance. I've reported on a mediation process where death threats got to the point of people breaking into the garden of a farmer and killing the little lamb that were being fed, sort of hand fed, because their parents had died, the mothers, sows had died, whatever you call it, and spewing their guts across the window and across the garden, slashing tires, stealing stock, breaking tractors. Throwing rocks through windows. This is all sort of mediation process when you have unresolved land disputes. So it's important to bear in mind when you're thinking about the rural land disputes that you often have very heavily armed and angry people that are trying to grow their turf. And they are now going to, and always, always alongside and coming in from the big cities, there's some land activist who's got a very clever theory about how you can tell whether someone's good or evil depending on their skin color, who is there to support one side of the affair. Mm-hmm. And that is the pool of intellectuals out of which the assessors are going to be drawn. So, you know, one thing I said is just imagine the EFF. Look at the way they behave in Parliament. Imagine if you gave each of them a gavel with which they could crush the heads of their enemies with the full might of the South African police service, the army, and everything that goes with a judgment in a court of law. That is what this bill does. And it's not an exaggeration to say that it's going to open up ordinary South Africans to dangerous abuse. But I just want to finish by saying it's a terrible mistake to think this is just going to play out in rural South Africa, because again, it changes the jurisdiction of evictions from the High Court and therefore Supreme Court of Appeal channel to the Land Court channel. So if you're in an urban area and someone's in your Airbnb and they won't leave, you're going to be going in front of one of these like Land Court assessors. They're going to figure out whether you're right or wrong too. It really needs to stop. And I think that this is, as I said last week about the expropriation bill and the Land Court bill being signed off at committee level, this is a very real opportunity for the so-called opposition coalition to stand up and make themselves heard, to say with one clear shared voice that this is a threat to South African human rights that cannot be broached and that must be stopped. It would be very useful for them to send that signal, both domestically and for the international community that might be interested, and for them to get a sense of where they want to take the country, whether it's in this direction or not.
Well said. I don't know, Gabriel, if you just want to maybe briefly touch on the alternatives to the Land Courts bill that the IRR has been.
Yeah, very briefly. I mean, we put the document out in 2019, but even before, that was just the latest instance of it. Ipuluza is the name of the IRR's sort of rural land program, means farm in Zulu. And I think everyone watching this is already going to know the basic ideas. Privatizing land is hugely important. So at the moment, 21 million South Africans roughly are living on government land. It should all be private. It should be title deeds. The title deeds need to be solidified by backing them up with proper property rights that are properly administered by an independent judiciary. You need extension services because people can't get goods to market when the roads don't work, when they can't get good sprays and water damming, contouring and such like, and some of those things are difficult to do. So you can have the government subsidizing or hiring genuine independent experts to do that instead of trying to run it out of the DLDR, which is just always a mess. And in terms of upskilling, yes, the IRR consistently argues for major investment in genuine upskilling, which, you know, through an elective system. In other words, you subsidize people who want to go and get an education. You don't set up a new TVET college yourself. You let people set up TVET colleges and you use budgetary resources. You know, you use the education budget to help people along there. There's a huge hunger for growth. Not much of that is directed towards the agricultural sector. Most of it in South Africa is directed towards the urban sector. But we have potential to do much better than we're doing agriculturally if we would just take the roughly 50% of land value, according to AgriSA, which is sitting 40% in government hands in the wet half of the country. If you turn that into private land with, you know, ordinary South Africans, almost all of them black, taking their fate into their own hands, you're going to see the best of humanity rather than right now where you see the worst of centralization, maladministration, lack of resources, and so on.
Very well said. All right, so let's move on to our next topic.
Do you mind if I just add one simple thing? I in fact had the report that Gabriel was referring to open on the screen as he was speaking. It was, as he pointed out, the 2019 report with a wonderful title, Reaching the Promised Land. It really is reachable. But there was just one little detail that Gabriel mentions, he touches on in the press release today, but it's about what we say could be done. You set up a commercial farming fund. And in 2019, Anthea Jeffrey, the author of the report, said that if you took a portion of the overall Eskom bailout of that year, which in 2019 was 59 billion, you put that into this commercial farmers fund. You're spending any additional money. You're rather using the money you've already got for a much more productive purpose. The IRR calculated that this could fund roughly 2,950 new commercial farmers in a single year. That's a very significant figure of new entrants into the rural economy, farming economy, which is, of course, crucial to life in the city. It's the reason why food is affordable and food is available and so on. So it's a pretty practical, directly kind of beneficial process that the IRR has proposed to have crafted in this proposal. Reaching the Promised Land is very good report, certainly worth my reading. I just really wanted to add that.
Yeah, Nick, throw in the link in the chat.
I definitely will do so after I've introduced our next topic, and I'll also put it in the YouTube comment section. So if you're listening on audio only, go find us on YouTube and you'll be able to find it there. Okay. So for our next topic, this is a little bit of a sort of interesting one, and I'm surprised considering, you know, how much of our national dialogue is hyper-focused on race, that this hasn't featured more in the news. But a guy called Harry Johannes Quinson, who's about 63 years old, was convicted and sentenced in Mpumalanga High Court for the contravention of planning, of preparing and planning to carry out terrorist attacks, incitement to carry out terrorist attacks in South Africa, soliciting support, recruitment of persons to carry out terrorist attacks in South Africa, and unlawful possession of a firearm. Now, it's a little bit unclear to me from the reporting exactly what the sort of some of the legal circumstances are here, because there was a report that he was at least convicted of some of these charges after pleading not guilty back in June of this year. But I see that SAPS is again talking today about his conviction. So perhaps he was convicted for some of these charges originally, and the rest of them today. But anyway, so this guy was apparently, according to the National Prosecuting Authority, planning to carry out an attack on Black South Africans that he believed was motivated by a sort of divine mission. That he wanted to attack government institutions, more specifically the police and military institutions, as well as townships and informal settlements, I think his phrase was hand the government back to whites. He's received a sentence of life and an additional 21 years. He was also charged alongside at least two other people, a guy called Donald Abrahams and another guy called Errol Abrahams, who both pled guilty when they were charged. Used in evidence in his trial was a series of videos that he put out on social media calling for an armed uprising of white people across the country. Gabriel, let me start with you. This is a weird case, I think, for a lot of reasons, but I think, you know, we were having a conversation beforehand. It's very much not the norm in South Africa.
Yeah, I think it's condemnable. If everything is as it appears to be, this person is a racist who was trying to do something about it, and there's really that's not acceptable behavior in this country. The law has run its course. And it's important for us to remember that most South Africans are nothing like this. Institute of Race Relations independently commissioned surveys have repeatedly shown that the ordinary experience day to day of being in South Africa is of poverty, of a desperate need for more employment, of frustration with crime and corruption, of miserable service delivery that leaves much to be desired, and of a willingness to work together across racial lines and an understanding that that is an essential ingredient for us to go forward. If you just look at the figures of, you know, when people are asked, have you personally experienced any form of racism in the last year or two coming out of Stats SA's data, they've got about 90% saying, no, I haven't. And if you ask in the last 5 years coming out of the IRR's data, it's about 80% of Black respondents say, no, I haven't experienced any form of racism. So I think on that alone, you can say that this guy's really outstanding, not in a good way. That all being said, I find something – I just want to highlight a couple of things about the reporting that frustrate me. One is in the SAPS, the South African Police Service themselves highlight this thing as a right-winger. I'm not sure that they've ever identified anyone as a left-winger. And I think that it's just a sort of a bit of a bogey term. Myself, I'm not on either wing. I'm a radical centrist. I suppose I sympathize with anyone who would rather just go away from that kind of language, because it's so seldom helpful, but it's just a sort of point to note. I think also, curiously, I haven't read this case myself, and most of the cases that I've reported on, I have read the docket. So I have some sense that high courts in the hinterland can play fast and loose with justice. I feel a little bit of a red flag when I see things like, you know, important evidence was, you know, that he's trying to organize a terrorist insurrection on Facebook. It seems through public posting.
Pro tips to terrorists out there. No.
And this guy has served his own defense. He didn't have a lawyer, according to the SAPS report. So, you know, it's also worth wondering if he's a Looney Tune and whether a proper defense was mounted insofar as one is reasonable and just. Now, I don't want to second guess that too hard, but it's just to say. I wish I could take it for granted that that everything had gone as it's supposed to in terms of the court procedure, but I know what I'm going to be doing this weekend. I'm going to be reading this case because I find this kind of thing fascinating.
So, Michael, you were in adulthood through the transition in 94, and from what I understand of the dialogue about South Africa was that, you know, we were headed for some great, huge race war-driven bloodbath, and there was a lot of people who were very afraid of this. And it didn't happen, right? There was a lot of violence in this country. A lot of people were killed, but the great racial civil war never materialized. And since then, I think the only sort of white supremacist violence we've seen was, I think, the Burumakh trial, when some white supremacists blew up a bomb and some bombs in Soweto and killed, I think it was 3 or 4 people, and then got caught and sentenced. But really, it is something we've managed to avoid. What's your take on all of this?
I often think back to a thought that the historian C.W. de Kivit wrote, I think in the 40s, his great 2-volume history of South Africa, but where he pointed out that, you know, people moving across the terrain of what would become South Africa in the early years, the past 350 years, were compelled by much the same things, the need for grass, the need for water, and they were compelled on those grounds to actually find some kind, well, they were compelled to find common ground, but they, on the basis of that common ground, they had to actually know each other. They had to, even if they clashed, it was a gathering intimacy that developed in the society. I've often kind of thought about that. It's a complex thing because, of course, intimacy can also have a great deal of hatred in it. But in fact, we're not really a hateful society in the way that I think many people overseas, for instance, mistake us as being. We are a society of familiars, and that familiarity can sometimes be jarring. But I don't think there's this kind of revolutionary fervor here and that revolutionary heat, which, you know, so you often see this phrase, we're ticking time bomb or tinderbox or whatever. I don't think that's literally the kind of society we are. And it's reflected politically, I think, perhaps there's a risk of being contradicted by ensuing events. But if you look at the performance of the Economic Freedom Front, the kind of radical wing of the ANC, if you like, they're pretty much stuck in the same place. There isn't, or doesn't seem to be, this sort of political hinterland for them that's growing and represents some kind of future. I think South Africans are pretty moderate. They share a great deal of regard for one another across whatever historical divides they are, and economic ones, political, economic, racial, class, whatever, religion. There's a kind of common ground in this country which stands us in very good stead. We were joking a bit before we went on air that, you know, one of the kind of dubious virtues of 28 years of ANC rule, which really pushed the country to its limits, is that we've been kind of stress tested, and it shows in the fact that somebody like this person stands out as a rare oddity. It's quite a peculiar thing for people to confront, this a man who wants to be killed.
As Gabriel suggested, very much comes across as a Looney Tune.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, Gabriel, any final thoughts on this? Well, I don't think Gabriel can hear me. Anyway, I think we're pretty much there for time. So With that, I hope that you all enjoy the show. We will be back tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show, and I hope you all have a magnificent and wonderful day. Cheers, everyone, and have a good one.